Good day. Today is Friday, 27th February 2026. And before I proceed with this programme, let me remind you again to tick the like button and to check your subscription to this channel. If once you've watched this programme or whichever part of this programme you want to watch, you decide that you like what you've seen and heard and wish to indicate that fact. Now, before I proceed, I'll discuss briefly the topics that I intend to talk about in the programme today. Firstly, I'm going to touch on the situation in the diplomacy in the Iran crisis. Then I'm going to revert to the larger, longer part of the programme, which will deal with the Ukraine situation, the conflict in Ukraine. And then, if there's time, I will finish by discussing the latest British parliamentary by-election and the entirely predictable defeat of Keir Starmer's Labour Party in that election in Greater Manchester. So let me first of all begin with the situation in the diplomacy in Iran, with Iran, between the United States and Iran. Now, yesterday, US and Iranian officials, Steve Witkoff and Jared Kushner, representing the United States. As it happens, I'm not sure whether either of those two gentlemen can be properly described as officials. Witkoff does have some kind of role in the American government, but I'm not sure what role Jared Kushner does. I know I've said this many times, but it still seems to me extremely strange that a private individual whose only position is that of the president's son-in-law should be involved in diplomacy at this level. Anyway, Jared Kushner and Steve Witkoff met in Geneva with the Iranian foreign minister, Abbas Araghchi. And Araghchi came with a set of proposals from Iran, and they were very much the proposals that we have heard about many times, and which were, by the way, already floating around last year. Iran would not abandon its nuclear enrichment program. It considers, in fact, it does have a right to conduct nuclear enrichment within the terms of the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty. Iran has never violated its obligations under the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty. Iran will therefore continue nuclear enrichment within its own territory, though it is prepared to suspend it for a period of between 2 and 5 years, subject, I presume, to negotiations. And it will dilute its existing uranium stockpile, enriched uranium stockpile, during that period to levels presumably below the 3 or 4% that would be acceptable for a civilian program. IAEA inspections would resume. Other types of inspection of Iranian nuclear facilities would be open for discussion. And at the end of the period when enrichment in Iran is suspended, Iran would join a consortium of countries. We're not told which countries, but presumably it's mostly the regional Arab states, though it might conceivably also include Russia. And those countries would then conduct nuclear enrichment, some of which would be conducted, again, subject to international inspections on the territory of Iran. Now, to me, that looks like an entirely satisfactory proposal. It is very difficult to imagine, It is all but inconceivable in the event of this kind of proposal being accepted that Iran would be able to move forward to develop a nuclear device, a nuclear weapon. What I would say is that the proposal that Iran dilute its existing nuclear stockpile, or its existing stockpile of highly enriched uranium, appears to admit that that stockpile actually exists. In other words, as was pointed out by many people at the time, including, by the way, us on the Duran and myself on this program, the attack on the nuclear facilities at Fordow, Natanz, and Isfahan, which was conducted by the United States in June 2025, was only partially successful. It did not destroy the entirety of Iran's nuclear stockpile. Perhaps it didn't destroy any part of Iran's highly enriched uranium stockpile, which is exactly what we thought was likely at the time. Of course, we don't know how much of that stockpile still exists or where it might be. There's some reports that the United States believes that that stockpile has been hidden in a secret tunnel in Isfahan. Who knows? But it does look as if the Iranians admit finally to its existence. But then they never denied before the June 2025 attack that this stockpile existed. And that, of course, was the source of much of the controversy. The only period when there was some doubt was after the June 2025 attack, when the Americans, the President of the United States, Donald Trump, insisted that the nuclear facilities had been completely obliterated and that Iran's nuclear enrichment program had been entirely ended, whereas, of course, the Iranians were careful to say nothing at all. Anyway, there it is. So that was the Iranian proposal. Now, the Americans, by contrast, made that came with their own proposals. And if the Wall Street Journal is to be believed, these were proposals of astonishing radicalism. On the nuclear issue, they didn't just require Iran to give up enrichment entirely, but to agree to the total destruction of the previous enrichment facilities in Fordow, Isfahan, and Natanz. Again, an admission from the United States this time that these facilities might have been less extensively damaged than the president himself previously alleged and might conceivably be capable of being brought back by Iran to a full state of repair. Just saying. So that was one demand. And of course, there were other demands. There were demands relating to ballistic missiles. There were demands relating to Iran's network of regional alliances. But already it seems to me that the demand on nuclear enrichment and on nuclear facilities was extraordinarily extreme. And the United States was giving nothing in return. It was making no promise, as far as I could see, that Iran would not be attacked in the future. It was making no promise that any of the sanctions imposed on Iran would be lifted. It was giving no timeline for when those sanctions might be lifted. It said that the United States would take it upon itself to supervise what Iran was doing, and that in its own time, if it chose, it might decide to grant Iran a certain amount of sanctions relief. It's inconceivable that the Iranians would accept that kind of proposal, which is a proposal so extreme that I doubt that most countries would accept it, and which the Iranians, having listened to what President Trump said about their country and its political system over the course of his State of the Union address, would surely judge was intended by the United States if Iran complied with those demands to be a stepping stone towards eventual regime change in Iran, a further attack on a now defenseless Iran intended to achieve regime change in that country. And, well, there was no way that the Iranians were going to accept that, and of course they didn't. Now, after this meeting in Geneva, reports circulated that the Americans, Witkoff and Kushner, came away disappointed, that they were perhaps expecting that the Iranians would accede to what was, to all intents and purposes, an American ultimatum, and they were disappointed when this was not the case. But the foreign minister of Oman, who is acting as mediator, said that in fact things were not so bad, and the Iranians were also saying that things were not so bad, and that in fact, despite the apparent deadlock, some kind of good atmosphere or better atmosphere was being created, and that there would be a further round of talks next week in Vienna, though these are described as technical talks. I will say, by the way, at the outset, that I have absolutely no idea what technical talks means in this context. Technical talks about what precisely, given that there is no agreement at all on the substantive issues. Anyway, all of this that went back to the United States, the Iranians and the Omanis went back to their respective countries. The Iranians and the Omanis said that the negotiations were still underway, that there would be these technical talks in Vienna, and that it looked as if the negotiations would continue. But previously, we'd heard the report that the Americans, Witkoff and Kushner, came away from the meeting disappointed. Now, over the last few hours, just before I made this programme, we've been getting some very, very concerning news. Now, Larry Johnson on Sonar 21, his invaluable blog, recently published a piece saying that one of the strongest indicators that an attack against Iran was coming would be if the United States started to evacuate embassy personnel from its various embassies and started to advise its citizens to leave relevant countries in the Middle East. Well, just before I started making this programme, reports appeared that the British government has advised British citizens to leave Iran and is reducing the number of embassy personnel at the British embassy in Tehran. At the same time, the United States is giving advice to US citizens to consider whether they wish to remain in Israel, and there are reports that it is evacuating some of its embassy personnel from Israel, and we will see whether these instructions begin to extend. to other embassies in the Middle East. There's also been a speech by the US Vice President J.D. Vance. He said that the one possibility that can be completely excluded is a long war in the Middle East between the United States and Iran, that is absolutely not on the agenda, that is not going to happen, which I have to say suggests to me, strongly suggests to me, that a decision to attack Iran has been made, and that what Vance is doing is to try to reassure the American public that when it starts, it won't be a precursor to a long war in the Middle East. As to whether such assurances carry any weight or value in light of what the Iranians themselves have been saying, well, I can't see how Vance can talk for the Iranians. The Iranians are talking about a long war if they are attacked in any way. Whether they're able to sustain that long war is another matter. But the Americans themselves, we've had a cascade of reports from the United States which say that the United States itself is not able to sustain a long war. And in some ways, you could argue that Vance's comments are a further American admission of that fact. But coming back to my main point, Vance's comments and these evacuations of British and American citizens and embassy personnel from the Middle East are a very, very strong sign, as Larry Johnson highlighted some days ago, that an attack on Iran is about to happen. So I'm going to make a guess. It could be this weekend, despite the fact that we are now in the full moon period, or so I believe. Well, it looks as if this time the president is going to ignore any warnings in that regard, which he might have received. And we will have to see what happens. We will have to see how stable the government in Iran continues to be and to what extent it is able to follow through on its threats to sustain a long war. And we will also have to see if the Iranian government does survive, does endure, and is able to maintain a long war, what the United States, and by the way, Israel, do in that case. Now, I'm going to just quickly add something else. All of the indications are that General Kane, on behalf of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, and John Radcliffe, the director of the Central Intelligence Agency, both advised the president last Sunday that they could not guarantee success in this operation, success being the overthrow of the government of Iran, and that the possibility of a long war was real. Nonetheless, it does look today as if the president and his officials, his advisers, have decided to take the plunge. After the extraordinary words of his State of the Union address, I have to say that I personally had few such doubts. In which case, the United States, the president, is taking a gamble on a war, a completely unnecessary war, in which, prior to which, the other side has put forward an entirely reasonable proposal on the matter at issue, which is Iran's nuclear enrichment program. However you spin it, However you try to justify it, this is a straightforward case, or so it seems to me, of the United States attacking a country which, far from threatening any other country at this time, is making serious proposals in order to achieve peace. One might not like its political system or its ideology. Everybody has a right to opinions about that. But disliking the government of a particular country has never been grounds to conduct war. But that, it seems, is what the United States is about to do, taking extraordinary risks in the process. We will see how that goes. But no one should be in any doubts about this, and I, for one, frankly appalled by it. Anyway, let's move on and return to the other big topic of these programs, and that is the conflict in Ukraine. And the first thing to say is that there was supposed to be, or there were reports circulating over the last couple of days that the Ukrainians, the Russians, and the Americans were going to have some further contacts in Geneva. And I took this to mean that Medinsky, Kostyakov, and the other Russian negotiators would be traveling to Geneva and they would meet there with the Ukrainians and the Americans, exactly as had happened before, in fact, last week, and that there would be longer and deeper negotiations around that. Well, I'm not sure that it doesn't seem, in fact, as if anything like that has actually happened. I've seen no reports in the Russian media that a Russian delegation, negotiating team, has travelled to Geneva and has met the Americans and the Ukrainians. I have to say that even if there'd been a decision in Moscow to downplay reporting of the negotiations in Geneva, which would have been an interesting and important fact in itself, I still think that even in that case, we would have had some reports appearing somewhere about the fact that Medinsky and the other Russian negotiators were heading to Geneva to meet the Americans and the Ukrainians. The fact that there have been no such reports, none that I can find, and I found no such reports in the British or European media either, or indeed the American media, lead me to think that there were no negotiations of that sort in Geneva yesterday, and that no such negotiations are going to take place in Geneva today. Instead, what did happen was that Kirill Dmitriev, the head of Russia's Direct Investment Fund, another person who, by the way, has no official position in the Russian government and who is not a diplomat, though someone who does have a public position in that the Direct Investment Fund is a public body in Russia. Anyway, he was in Geneva and he does seem to have had a meeting with Witkoff. Though it's completely uncertain to me what exactly it was that Witkoff and Dmitriev discussed. The word is that the Russians, Dmitriev, are imposing a blanket silence on these talks and that at the same time, nothing significant or substantive was achieved by them. In fact, Peskov says that there has been no severance of the economic discussions between the United States and Russia and the Ukraine conflict. They are still interconnected with each other. And without any progress on the Ukraine conflict, there cannot be any progress in terms of bilateral relations between Russia and the United States, including bilateral economic relations. And in the absence of any substantive political talks between the Ukrainians and the Russians, I'm unable myself to see what the point of this meeting between Witkoff and Dmitriev actually was. Perhaps Dmitriev was passing on messages to Witkoff from the Russians, from Putin specifically. Maybe Dmitriev was there to remind Witkoff again of what Witkoff and Trump proposed in the summer, with demands that Witkoff and Trump stick by whatever commitments they made then. But it looks as if negotiations at the moment are not only at standstill, but are perhaps more properly speaking, not even happening at all, which brings us back to the military situation. Now, the military situation at the moment continues to involve further movement on the battlefronts and continued Russian attacks from the sky. Yesterday, I spoke about a major Russian combined missile and drone strike against Ukraine. There's been still a sparsity of information about exactly what that strike achieved, but there are some claims, which I saw this morning, that six Ukrainian regions are either entirely out of power or are short of it. There were also reports this morning that the Ukrainians have launched another 10 Flamingo missiles into Russia, though no word at all of what, if anything, these missiles are supposed to have struck, or whether they struck anything at all. But on the actual front lines, there does continue to be movement, and the most dramatic movement is now happening in Konstantinovka. And I said some days ago that the Russians seem to be at the centre of Konstantinovka. I understand that there is now footage which confirms this, and it does look as if the Russians are in the business, are now quickly asserting control of southwestern Konstantinovka. That resistance there has, Ukrainian resistance there, which has been crumbling, is now perhaps better expressed as collapsing. And of course, if southwestern Konstantinovka does fall under Russian control, the rest of the city will follow, the rest of the town will follow very fast, because this is where the high-rise buildings and the major fortified positions are apparently located, even though Ukrainian logistics in this area are difficult and made more difficult by the the flooding caused by the recent destruction by the Russians using a Fab 3000 bomb of a dam, which has caused flooding that's cut off the supply lines, the supply roads, into parts of Konstantinovka. So this seems to me to be, by a significant distance, the most important news. And it brings us ever closer to the point where it looks as if the siege of the remaining Ukrainian conurbation, Slavyansk and Kramatorsk, will begin, with a Russian military commentator, as I discussed some days ago, talking about the biggest cauldron of the war being created around Slavyansk and Kramatorsk, where the major part of the Ukrainian forces in Donbass are located. Radovka, the Russian newspaper in Smolensk, also provided some further news. Radovka claims that the Russians have now captured the village of Grishino, apart from a few remaining Ukrainian positions on its outskirts. Radovka says that the fall of Grishino completes the securing of the Pokrovsk conurbation. Pokrovsk and Mirnograd fell to the Russians some weeks ago, and that the fall of Grishino also dooms the Ukrainian garrison further north in the village of Belitskaya and opens the way for the Russians to capture the town of Dobropilia further to the north, in which case the Russians are well positioned to complete the encirclement of Slavyansk and Kramatorsk from the west. So the Russians are advancing on Slavyansk and Kramatorsk from the west, are completing the encirclement from the west with the fall of Grishino and before long the fall of Belitskaya and the coming assault on Dobropilia. And the Russians are in the process of storming Konstantinovka. And to the northeast, the Russians are also advancing westwards from Siversk towards Slavyansk and Kramatorsk, and are starting to approach the village of Rai Alexandrovka. In fact, Igor Kimakovsky, the aide of Denis Pushilin, the head of the Donetsk regional government, he actually gave an interview to TASS in which he spoke about how the battle for Rai Alexandrovka is about to begin. And he corroborated the point made by Scott of Calibrated, and which you can find out all about by going to Scott's maps, that this village is the high ground. Capture of this village essentially cuts all possibility of communications between Slavyansk in the north and Kramatorsk in the south. These two towns are in effect divided by each other. I remember reading all about this in Radovka some days ago. And when that happens, that big cauldron in Slavyansk, Kramatorsk is created. Now, there's lots going on in other places. The Russians continue to claim that they are advancing towards Orekhov. The Ukrainians continue to claim that they're conducting their offensive in northeastern Zaporozhye region. The Russians say that this Ukrainian offensive in northeastern Zaporozhye region is at a standstill and that the Ukrainians have suffered severe losses in this area and have achieved nothing. And the Russians also continue to claim, and about this there is extensive corroboration, that they are now very close to clearing the remaining Ukrainian defences on the east bank of the Oskol River in the Kupiansk area, and that they're pushing south towards the city of Sumy. So this is the military situation. Now, again, I provided an outline, but perhaps more interesting, or at least I found it more interesting, is that we've also now had a discussion about this whole situation in foreign affairs, the military situation in foreign affairs. Foreign affairs is one of the three big heavyweight American foreign policy journals. One is Foreign Policy, the other is Foreign Affairs, and the third is the national interest, with foreign affairs and foreign policy, perhaps the two slightly more heavyweight journals of the two. And to be frank, I find them very similar. And the type of articles they publish also seems to me to be very similar. Anyway, we have had an article in Foreign Affairs by Michael Desch, who we're told is a professor of international relations of Notre Dame, and well, anyway, is a top foreign policy, foreign affairs expert in the United States. And his article is entitled, Ukraine is Losing the War. With Moscow pressing its advantage, Kiev should trade land for peace. And the article goes into things, goes into the realities in great detail. It looks at the military balance. It says that Ukraine's losses are unreplaceable. Russia's losses are not. With every passing day, the military balance on the battlefields in Ukraine tilts further to Russia's advantage, that the Russians have superiority in tanks, superiority in aircraft, superiority in drones, both battlefield drones and strategic drones, obviously superiority in missiles, and an overwhelming superiority now in artillery, that Ukraine lacks the manpower to plug the holes in the front lines, that if Ukraine continues fighting, it will lose more territory and it will certainly eventually lose Donbass, and that from every conceivable point of view, from every available metric, Ukraine is losing the war and needs to make peace, and it needs to make that peace as soon as possible, because if it fails to do so, then the situation on the ground over time will shift even further to its disadvantage. Anyway, that was Michael Desch's argument in Foreign Affairs, and obviously I cannot disagree with it. In fact, it is the same point that I have been making basically since the start of the special military operation. Others too, Daniel Davis, who's Daniel Davis Deep Dive, I regularly appear on. Other places like that, as other people have been saying the same thing, that the balance of military and economic power in this war is tilted massively in Russia's favour. Russia has four times Ukraine's population. In reality, in my opinion, the discrepancy is actually greater, because I suspect that Ukraine's population statistics have been inflated for years, and that the actual living population in Ukraine itself has been further much reduced since the war. And of course, Yulia Mendel, Zelensky's former spokesman, said that many of the people, perhaps most of the people who still live in Ukraine, are pensioners. So Russia can replace its losses. Ukraine cannot. Russia can replenish its arsenals and its equipment and build them up further. Ukraine cannot. Whatever strains there may be in the Ukraine, in the Russian economy, real or imagined, they don't compare with the far greater crisis that Ukraine's economy is facing. The balance in Russia's favour is so lopsided that for Ukraine to continue fighting makes no sense, and it is time, in fact, time is overdue for Ukraine to make peace. And of course, this is essentially the same point made in our live stream yesterday by Willie O.M., the Australian analyst, who's also been assessing the metrics in the war, as I discussed in my program yesterday. And he speaks from a pro-Ukrainian position. More and more people in the United States can see it. More and more people in Ukraine itself can see it. But from Zelensky himself, there is never the word peace. There is never the word peace in Europe either, not from any of the European leaders. They continue to insist that Ukraine is holding its own, that the front lines are in stalemate, even though they are not, that the Russians are suffering impossibly high losses that they cannot replace, and that if the war continues, the Russians will eventually lose momentum and the war will end in some form of a Ukrainian victory. Though at the current price, the cost of that victory would for Ukraine also, it seems to me, by now be completely exorbitant. Well, I should say that, as is well known, I have never believed Ukrainian claims, or indeed Western claims, about the scale of Russian losses. And I ought to say again and remind you, my viewers, that as it happens, I actually believe that I know what Ukrainian losses were up to August 2025, and they're multiples greater than what you see reported in the West, even though they are also below, and this must be said, some of the more extreme claims that one reads in the Russian media and associated outlets. And I also believe, incidentally, or at least I have a shrewd idea of what Russian losses also are. And they don't come anywhere close also to the claims that the Ukrainians and people in the West make. But I was particularly interested by an article that was referenced to me by the British historian Jeff Roberts, which comes from Medusa. Now, Medusa, for those who don't know, is a dissident, anti-Putin, Russian website, news site. I believe it is published in Latvia, just to say. And I also believe that it receives some of its funding from none other than the fugitive Russian oligarch, Mikhail Khodorkovsky, who is, of course, a bitter enemy of President Putin. Medusa is a very strong oppositionist Russian website. It is certainly not a website that is going to be at all sympathetic or favourable to Putin or his government. And for the record, I also believe that it is sympathetic to Ukraine in this war. Now, Medusa has said that the numbers, the figures of dead Russians supposedly killed in the special military operation, with which Mediazona, the agency that's working with the BBC, but also other agencies that seek to collate Russian casualties, that these figures are distorted. And interestingly enough, they're distorted and inflated by the Russian Defense Ministry itself. Supposedly, over the course of 2025, the Russian Defense Ministry embarked on a campaign to convert soldiers who are missing in action into dead soldiers, to relabel them dead soldiers, from the period of the special, from the start of the special military operation in 2022. And that this has caused an upward bump in some of the information about dead Russian soldiers in 2025, because this is when the relabeling of many of these MIA soldiers has been taking place. And this is leading to a belief in the West that there has been a spike in Russian losses in 2025, which is an entirely statistical and administrative phenomenon. It has no actual reality at all. The article in Medusa, in fact, is very interesting because it says that the whole issue of casualties, especially Russian casualties, is distorted, and by the fact that in the West and in Ukraine, all Russian casualties are lumped together. That includes dead, wounded, and seriously wounded, even though wounded is by far the biggest category of the three, and the vast majority of those achieve a complete recovery and rejoin their units. Just saying. So, anyway, Medusa, no less, as I said, this very strong anti-Putin website, even they are now saying that the figures that the West, Western media, Western governments, Western political leaders, Ukrainian leaders are working on for Russian losses are distorted and inflated and unreliable, and that in reality, the Russians are having no difficulties replacing their losses. And in fact, their numbers, the overall numbers of their army, is actually growing. So there it is. I mention all of this, and that also going back to that article by Michael Dench brings us back to the question of what is going on in the war, which is that the Ukrainians, what is actually happening in the war is that the Ukrainians are being ground down, that the Russians continue to advance, that the Russians are now poised to break through in Donbass. We could be seeing a major battle in Donbass this summer, and a collapse of Ukrainian resistance in Donbass. And the Russians could be poised also to break through to Zaporozhye and to the Dnieper. And as the Ukrainians now fear, as I discussed in my program yesterday, for the Russians to cross the Dnieper and to move on towards Odessa itself. Now, saying all of this, I ought to say that Putin himself continues to remain very quiet on Ukraine-related issues. He's not made a major speech about this subject. He's not had meetings with the generals so far this year, at least not that I can remember, certainly not for many weeks. And the overall sense is that the Russians are building up their forces, shaping the battlefield, and that the military, it is the military who are in full control of the situation. Now, again, we come to the question of why there was no meeting in Geneva between the Russians, the Americans and the Ukrainians yesterday. I have already said that Zelensky does not want these sort of negotiations to continue. He's trying again to divert the whole topic of negotiations to a trilateral meeting between himself, Trump and Putin, perhaps in Abu Dhabi. Just saying. But my own view is that the Russians also are less interested in negotiations at this time. That they are shaping the battlefield. They are attacking the Ukrainian energy system. They're apparently attacking the railway lines, by which I mean that they're not attacking the actual railways themselves, but they're increasingly targeting railway infrastructure, the railway bridges, the train sets, the locomotives. And they're also, of course, attacking military targets. They are attacking the warehouses, the production facilities, the training facilities across Ukraine. And that what we will probably see is Putin reemerge, perhaps once the Battle of Konstantinovka is either over or nearly over. And then we will start to get hints from him, not perhaps so much hints, but statements from him that the Russians have upped their demands. Because this is where I think events are now clearly heading. I noticed that the former Ukrainian Prime Minister, Nikolai Azarov, who is currently in Moscow in exile, he was Yanukovych's Prime Minister, but he still remains a regular commentator in the Russian media on Ukrainian affairs. He has ridiculed suggestions that there's any serious division between Budanov and Zelensky on negotiations. He says that neither of these two men really wants to make peace on any sort of terms that would be at all acceptable to Russia. And that, again, to my mind, seems to rule out negotiations at all. And given the prominence that Azarov has in the Russian media, I think that strongly points to Azarov having some sort of green light from the Russians to talk in this way. In which case, it's going to be a military focused campaign over the next few weeks and months, with Putin perhaps making renewed demands, one of which quite plausibly will be that Ukraine must give up more territory than just the four regions, and perhaps must also abandon its plans to join the EU also. Now, if that happens, I predict that it will be a shock for many people, including some people who have been clinging to the idea of EU membership as one possible bridge towards a negotiated resolution. But I strongly suspect that that is coming. Anyway, we shall see. But the war goes on, the preparations for the war continue, and we will see how it turns out. Negotiations, unlike the war, don't seem to be taking place at all, and that perhaps, at least for me, is the most telling thing of all at this time. Now, I said at the start of this program that I will discuss the situation with Keir Starmer, and that is what I now propose to do. The Labour Party suffered a catastrophic defeat at the by-election, the parliamentary by-election in Greater Manchester, a place called Gorton and Denton, a seat that Labour has held continuously since 1931. Just saying, it's the sixth most loyal, strongest Labour seat in Britain. It was one of the last places you would expect Labour to lose. And Labour, in the run-up to the announcement of the results, said that it was going to be a nail biter, that Labour was almost level with the Greens and Reform, and that it might lose. None of which, of course, was true. His vote, in fact, collapsed. The Greens were the clear winner in a working class constituency, which has never been an easy place for them to win before. Just saying. And Reform came second, and Labour came third. Labour came a poor third. Now, the Prime Minister, Keir Starmer, is, as I'm making this programme, telling the media that despite this defeat, he intends to continue. He intends to remain Prime Minister, that this is all very disappointing. That the Greens are extremists and the Reform Party is also extremist as well. Well, quite apart from the fact that the condition of Britain is not good, that the government has not been performing well, that Keir Starmer himself has not been performing well. The events of the last few weeks, Starmer's own decision to block Andy Burnham, the Mayor of Manchester, from standing for the Labour Party in this seat, in which case Burnham and Labour would, I have no doubt, have won. Plus, the Mandelson scandal made it actually inevitable that Labour would lose. I have to say, I was reading all of those reports about this being a nail-biter outcome, a vote that was too close to call, one which Labour might still win. I was reading all of these reports yesterday and over the last couple of days with mounting incredulity, and I was wondering on what planet the people who were writing them were on. It was clear to me that Labour would lose. And the only question was whether they would lose to the Greens or to Reform. And I'm going to say straight away that I think that Reform underperformed, partly perhaps there's been some allegations, I'm not sure how real they are, that there's been some, shall we say, cheating in the way in which the election was conducted, cheating presumably in favour of the Greens. I'm not sure how real those allegations are, but I will also say this: I think that Reform chose the wrong candidate for this by-election. They went for an academic, a professor, an intellectual, not at all the person I would have thought to put up as a candidate in a working class constituency of this kind, whereas the Green Party far more intelligently put up a local candidate who was young and photogenic, and who is also a plumber. In other words, comes from exactly the kind of demographic that many of the people in the constituency would be likely to relate to. But anyway, let's return to Keir Starmer. The main reason why Labour lost in this by-election, where they were certain to, where previously they'd always won, was because they went in with absolutely nothing interesting or positive or compelling to say. Their entire campaign was pitched on the fact, on the claim that reform was bad and that Labour was good and that you should vote for Labour to prevent reform winning. In other words, it was entirely negative. There was nothing, no positive message from the Labour Party was conveyed to the voters at all. And how could it be otherwise? Because the Prime Minister, Keir Starmer, has no positive message of any kind to give. He has no ideas. He has no policies. Or to be more precise, he has only one policy. That policy is to go on shoveling money to Zelensky, giving him weapons, and trying as hard as he can to create some means to send British troops to fight or to go to Ukraine, an idea that is massively unpopular with British voters. So Starmer had nothing good, intelligent, positive to say. When he visited the constituency, he didn't meet with the local people. He purely met Labour Party officials. He had nothing to say to the local people, and he knew it, and he certainly had nothing to say to them that might persuade them to vote for him. And he didn't want to hear, by contrast, what they were going to say to him, which is, for the sake of God, go. So, with a prime minister, a government, a party without any message is bound to lose. And in fact, what happened over the course of this by-election is that the older people, the older English working class people voted reform, and the younger people and the large Muslim community in this constituency voted instead for the Greens. And if things with Labour continue like this, the same pattern is going to happen in every constituency, in every election across Britain, up to and including the forthcoming general election, whenever that comes. We are actually looking now at a genuine existential moment for the Labour Party, a real possibility that it could be facing an extinction event. Well, what to do? The obvious thing to do is to tell Keir Starmer to go. But that, of course, is nowhere near enough. And if I have to be frank, I can't myself see how this Labour Party is ever going to reconnect again with British voters. So we are probably living in its final years. The same is true of the Conservatives. They also did disastrously in this seat. So did the Liberals, the third big establishment party in British politics, the one that nobody talks about anymore, even though they still command a large number of seats in the House of Commons. But they too are looking irrelevant and dated as politics in Britain change. This is the first by-election in modern British history, at least in England, where neither Labour nor Conservative were in second place. And that is a remarkable fact. The single biggest message from this election is that the British people, middle class, working class, whichever demographic you choose, have finally given up on their political class. They do not want to vote for any of the three big establishment parties that have dominated British politics since before the First World War. They're not attracted to the Labour Party. In fact, they're abandoning it en masse. They're not attracted to the Conservative Party. They're not attracted to the Liberal Party. I have little confidence or faith in the two new parties that are appearing, Reform on the right and the Greens on the left. But the fact that they are attracting support and that the old parties are not, to my mind, tells its own tale. We are on the brink of a political revolution in Britain. And the political class can shut its eyes to the fact and pretend that it isn't happening. But everything that it does now, every step that it makes, brings that political revolution closer. Anyway, this is where I'm going to finish today's programme. Let me remind you again, you can find all our programmes on our various platforms, Locals, Rumble and X, as well as our Substack site. Please remember to support our work via Patreon and Subscribestar, and by going to our shop, links under this video. Last but not least, please remember to tick the like button and to check your subscription to this channel if you've liked this video. Thank you again. More from me soon. Have a very good day.